Good morning. Call to order. September 2017 meeting of the Finance Committee. On behalf of the committee and the board, I want to welcome everybody back from a long summer vacation from the month of August. And look forward to a very productive year beginning this September and carrying over till next June when, at least for the Finance Committee side, we have a lot to do, and a lot that we have to do will begin today. So on the administrative matters, we have approval of an agenda. We have two items on the agenda. I assume you've all had an opportunity to review that. If so, I will entertain a motion for approval of the agenda. There is a motion, a second. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
We would normally have an approval of the minutes from our last meeting, which was July 13, but we will just put that off until the October meeting. Apparently, the review of those meetings and their preparation has not been completed internally as yet by staff, so we'll skip that approval process. So we have two items, as I say, on our agenda today, and I'd like to give you a quick overview of these two items before turning the floor over to Mr. Onosuke, the general manager, Mr. Wiedefeld, and Mr. Webster. First, staff will provide an overview of Metro's FY 2017 financial performance for both the operating and capital budget. That's for the year that just ended on June 30th, 2017. As my colleagues may recall, the board passed the FY 2017 budget prior to SafeTrack's formulation and implementation. However, through a number of actions taken by the general manager and his team, WMATA successfully ended the year with an almost balanced budget, an operating budget, a very small difference of $15 million in a budget of $1.8 billion, almost a footnote. And we reached a new high as far as capital plan investments were concerned. Dennis will provide the details of our year-end finish. Following that review, we will then turn our attention to the upcoming financial challenges as the general manager will review the Keep Metro Safe, Reliable and Affordable plan that he presented to the public earlier in the year and that was endorsed by the board with a resolution before our summer break. And that plan and the presentation today will focus on our six-year operating and capital funding requirements for the fiscal years 2019 through 2024. Mr. Onosuke, would you like to begin to lead us through the first item?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Our goal today is to update the committee on Metro's operating and capital investment result for FY 17. I will review the operating highlights, and then Mr. Webster will review the capital investment results. But as a reminder, I want to inform the committee that the numbers that we will discuss today are preliminary and may change as a result of the current external audit, which is ongoing. In terms of financial updates, on the operating budget, as the chairman just mentioned, Metro will end FY17 with a balanced operating budget, despite significant ridership and revenue decline during the year. And on capital, Metro invested a record amount of money in its capital assets in FY17 to help get the system back to a state of good repair. Other accomplishments that I want to point out include the recovery of over $189 million of legacy capital grant costs, as well as FTA's partial restoration of Metro's ECO privileges, which now allows Metro to timely recover capital expenses. On slide four, operating revenues ended the year at $160.3 million below budget, which is generally in line with the weak revenue outlook that we shared with the committee last February. At that time, as you recall, staff also shared with the committee management options to make sure that we ended the year with a balanced budget, as well as the $17.9 million that was available to help ensure that we had a budget balance. Those management actions, along with market favorability, helped Metro save over $100 million last year. And as the chairman mentioned, the remaining gap will be addressed using the prior budget surplus. But again, based on where we ended up, we will in fact not use or need all of that to balance the budget. Slide 5 shows some of the management actions, including the elimination of 700 positions, freezing vacant non-safety sensitive positions, and controlling absenteeism. Additional actions included changing non-rep healthcare, selling excess property, and deferring some reserve contributions. With those actions, we are in a good position to end the year with a balanced budget. And in terms of the numbers themselves, Metro generated $784 million last year in operating revenues compared to a budget of $900 million. On operating expenses, Metro spent $1.6 billion compared to a budget of $1.7 billion. The local subsidy for FY17, which is $845 million, does not change and, in fact, is the same number that was provided by the jurisdictions the previous year. But for the year, Metro ended up with a 48% recovery ratio, and as we discussed a little bit earlier, will end up balanced with use of the $17.3 million. And on the next slide, we provide a broader view of performance by asset expense categories, which shows, in essence, that all but three categories, school revenue, ended up positive. The three are overtime, services, and materials. And for overtime, it was driven primarily by the additional support for inspections on track to support safe track, among other things. Services was driven primarily by the delay in the implementation of alternative paratransit services, which is now scheduled to begin in September. And materials and supplies were driven primarily by additional need for spare parts for Metro's Get Well program for rail cars. With that, Mr. Chairman, I will turn it over to Mr. Webster to discuss the capital budget.
Thank you, Dennis. Program. Through the beginning of 18 and now over
investment through maintenance and overhaul of rehabilitation of the existing fleet. So much of the improvement that you're seeing in rail car reliability and production and offload is attributable to those new rail cars and reinvestment. Rail systems, Metro invested $73 million in FY 17 in propulsion and propulsion communications. After initial delays in the beginning of fiscal year, due to longer than anticipated procurement processes, both power programs, radio and wireless programs are now delayed. Four traction power substations were delivered during the year, and work is progressing on both above ground and below ground projects. Tracking structures, Metro invested $165 million through safe track and other critical efforts to improve the safety and reliability of track components and related structures. Safe track is included within the fixed rail program in this category, and including the surges that were completed in FY 16. Total investment in safe track was $162 million. Stations and passenger facilities, Metro invested $150 million during the year. Replacement and rehabilitation of vertical transportation assets, escalators, and elevators, continues largely on schedule. A large multi-year project to rehabilitate the Orange and Blue Line, second to the Orange and Blue Line, continued through FY 17. The project is expected to be wrapping up towards the end of the year. Boston Paratransit, all over 100 of the new vehicles scheduled for FY 17 were delivered during the year. Combination of CNG and hybrid buses now in service. Bus rehab program continues on schedule. And importantly, both the Cinderbed Road and Andrews Federal Campus bus garage projects beat the schedule expectations in the original budget and proceeded during the year. Cinderbed is expected to be complete in 2018. This is a support category measure invested $53 million. In FY 17, significant progress on the timekeeping system and rollout of that is underway. We also received 58 police agents. That concludes our presentation. The next quarterly financial update will be in November after the close of the fourth quarter.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Just two quick questions, and then we'll see if there's other questions. You indicated that the $15 million difference in subsidy will be covered by a transfer from the surplus of past years to this current FY 17 year. At what time would you want or would you be presenting to the board, the committee and the board, to take that action?
Mr. Chairman, we expect to come to seek the board's approval to do that in November of this year.
And the reason for the two-month delay?
Is to allow for completion of the audit, which, as this board knows, will be done in October, and then to the extent there are changes, you know, to incorporate those changes before seeking board action.
Would you anticipate any changes in the amount that needs to be transferred from the surplus to cover that deficiency?
Historically, there's been minor adjustments. We do not expect anything different this time.
I wanted to ask you a question about the appendix. Which shows that ridership was down in FY 17 for the full year as opposed to the prior year FY 16, Metro Rail down 8% and Metro Bus down 4%. So the two questions there. Now that SafeTrax has ended, do you have any information or data from the first 2.5 months of the current fiscal year as to whether ridership has now stabilized, especially Metro Rail ridership, and what's your expectation? If you can give us some prediction for FY 18.
The committee will be discussing ridership with the committee next month, and so that work is ongoing. Over the first few months, we've seen some rebound in ridership. It's still obviously less than where we want it to be, which is why additional actions or continued action on system safe general liability, you know, is key. To bringing our customers back. There is some more positive information on bus than rather rail than bus, where we're still seeing sudden weaknesses along key corridors.
I'm sorry, so on bus, you're saying that you are seeing some recovery of the decline?
We're seeing better rebounds on rail rather than bus.
Than on bus.
Correct.
Yeah. On bus, is there an assessment of why, since there wasn't work on bus, it was work, say, tracks on Metro Rail, why the decline in bus ridership in FY17 compared to the prior year?
No, again, obviously bus has its own sort of unique challenges. And we believe that those factors are all playing in respect to bus. But what we're seeing here is just not Metro. It's not just Metro. It's both in the region and nationally. But we have no unique set of facts, you know, that are driving our ridership versus everybody else's ridership.
Yeah, I mean, that's the issue I was going to raise, is that some meetings I've been at over the summer nationally, bus ridership on transit properties has declined across the board, and it seems to be accelerating as you get into more recent quarters. I'm just wondering if you're part of that that national trend, or whether there were some unique factors at Metro relating to SafeTrax that resulted in the decline.
Well, it looks obviously we've been impacted by the broader trend, but part of the work that our planning is doing is to see if there are unique factors in the region that we can address in one fashion or the other.
Thank you. Other questions from members of the committee? Mr. Boulder, since you're the lone representative of the district today, if you want seconds or thirds, the committee will
I'll take as much as you want to. I only have one question. The total investment in the rail systems category was $31 million, which was off budget by about 30%. Is there a reason for that discrepancy?
Sorry.
Is it the slow starts on some of these projects, Tom, or
yes,
systemically, what is going on?
The initial budget assumed award of contracts earlier than in the fiscal year than actually occurred.
What kind of contract? The signals and which one?
A contract for propulsion power upgrades and also the radio. radio and wireless above ground contract. Those contracts have now been awarded, so basically there's a right shift in the schedule of both of those fairly large projects.
Okay, so months and months ago I asked about propulsion power for 8-car trains. Is this related to my question that I never got an answer to back in the summer? That we have enough, with these contracts, will we have enough power to run the 8-car trains?
The specific contract in the propulsion power project in FY17 was upgrades on the Orange Line,
yeah.
and Orange and Blue Line, I believe. Those upgrades are related to ultimately capacity to run eight-car trains.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions? Gentlemen, ladies? Thank you. Here's the... We've exhausted the committee's questions for today. Mr. Wiedefeld.
Good morning. What I wanted to do was, since we've been haven't met for a while, and as before we get into the budget cycle starting next month in earnest, I just wanted to give an overview of the keeping Metro safe, viable, and affordable in terms of just some of the more specifics to it and then some of the ramifications if we do it. If we don't do it, I just thought it'd be good before we get into the budgeting cycle that we do that. So that's the purpose of today. I've broken it into both. Basically, I'm going to talk about capital first and then operating. So just by big structural background, a very large background, these are not anything that's new to the board. We have chronic capital under investment, you know, for decades, and we have an unsustainable operating model for these reasons. The big message of this slide is that we didn't get here overnight. And it's going to take a long time to get out of this, but we're trying to put forward a path to do that. So move into the capital program discussion. Just, again, at a very high level to give you some context setting, under FTA regulations, we need to do a capital needs inventory, which we are doing. We've done that, the initial part of that. It's due, I believe, in late 18, if I recall, in 18, maybe. 19. But we've been moving on that. And the first part of that was literally to do a physical inventory, and then we in effect aged out that inventory, and that led to roughly about a $25 billion investment. And we also put in there things that we would like to start to look at, new things, expansion. We then refined that and brought that down to roughly $15.5 billion over the next 10-year period, focusing on the existing system. Then the next sort of bar there shows that historically, if we kept at the levels we've been keeping at, we'd get about $8 billion over that 10-year period, which leaves about a $7.5 billion hole that we're trying to address. So just, you know, very large picture, that's what we're doing. We are continue to work on the needs inventory, and now we're going into basically an assessment of each asset that we inventoried. So it's not just that it's timed out, but physically where is it? Some things may need to be replaced earlier. Some things could actually go longer. So that's what we're refining those numbers. And so that's what's the technical information behind what's driving the needs. Okay? So in the spring, we came out with what we believe is a path forward for discussion. One is to keep the current jurisdictional contributions at the same level, with in effect trying to keep up with inflation. So we've basically assumed a 3% growth rate so that the different jurisdictions have some sense of their needs and their requirements going into the future. We've also suggested, again, that we need to invest at a higher level to get to that $5.5 billion over the 10 years and to move towards an annual average, and I want to stress that, an average annual investment of roughly $1.5 billion, because in capital programming, it's lumpy. Things go up, things go down, so it's not a straight line, you know, at that. So I just want to reinforce that. to do that, we believe that we need a stable revenue source to do that, so not only do we get the revenues in, but we can sell debt on it. Again, given the nature of capital programming, when you have a large project, you may want to sell debt to deliver that large project and spread out those payments over the years. We also believe that it should be kept away from operating expenses, and that it should be, in effect, in a lockbox that is used exclusively for capital. And then also, we do believe that the federal government still has a role in the future above and beyond what we get from formula dollars, similar to what we've had in the PREA dollars, roughly $150 million per year into the future. So if we just take a look at if those some of those things that we just outlined there do not occur, what does that start to mean? And basically what it means is almost a tripling of the investment from the local jurisdictions to support the program going forward. The next slide tries to give that a sense of by jurisdiction what that starts to mean, both by jurisdiction with and without some of the initiatives that we talked about, particularly the dedicated revenue, the ability to sell debt on it, and then also the PREA funding level continuing into the future. The next slide shows, in effect, if those things were put in place, how we would start to build the program, and then, in effect, that it maintains the jurisdictional level at what we consider a reasonable level of what's been done in the past with some minor growth in it, roughly 3%. Again, this isn't a capital budget by any means. It's not designed to be that, but is to give you a sense of the road ahead of us is because we would develop annual programming budgets to support this. Just Monday, we had Governor Hogan put forth the equivalent of a $2 billion additional capital funding mechanism for 4 years. Which he stipulated was not the long-term solution, but it would allow the time to come up with some of these longer-term solutions, particularly if we were going to deal with the dedicated tax and the debt affordability, the debt options associated with that. And what you see with that is that obviously it does give us the additional dollars. It increases the federal amount because it's not only the, in effect, he's seeking the 125 on top of the PREA dollars in there, and then also it basically does require the local jurisdictions to come up with the additional 125. So that's what this is showing. It shows you that, again, we do get to the same issue in a few years out. Again, as he recognized in his letter, that it was not the long-term solution, but it gave the window to solve some of those issues. The next slide is just a high-level summary of the types of projects. Again, Tom just went through the classifications of how we do the capital programming. The big message here is, this is nuts and bolts type of work that we have to do. It's keeping the basic system performing and improving, and not major new initiatives. One thing I also want to draw your attention to is the very last category, which is what we call the D&E, which is the Development Evaluation Program. And what we want to create there, and what I believe is needed, is we need a program where we have projects lined up. We understand what we are committing to. We go through that process so it feeds the capital program on an ongoing basis, which historically this agency has not had. I'll move now to the operating budget discussion. We have proposed is that we work to cap the annual operating contribution where it is with a 3% growth, recognizing that costs will go up, but again, to try to keep that tighter, to force ourselves to do that. We are looking to provide more flexibility in how we deliver some of the services through competitive contracting. We also believe that we would like to have some further clarification and limitations if we do go to binding arbitration, and that's through the Wolf Act amendments of the mid-90s, and also suggesting that for new employees that they are under a new retirement program, different than the current one for current employees, protect current employees, but for new employees, there would be a new benefits program for them. And then also we believe that we need to create a rainy day fund with a $1.8 billion annual operating budget. Literally, we have no contingency to deal with issues that come up during the year. To put that in a little bit greater perspective by jurisdiction, over the last 5 years, in effect, we've been averaging about a 9% increase in operating costs, and what that means in terms of the local contribution. As you know, in 18, we went through quite a tough budget process, but it did not address the structural issues. It dealt with the issue we had in front of us in fiscal year 18 and some of the actions we had to take there, whether the management actions that we took, some of the fair initiatives we had to do, the service adjustments. We reduced the grant funding from preventive maintenance to operating from 90 to 60, but it was still 60. Historically, we were in the $30 million range, for instance. We'll continue to do what we can do internally, but the margins that we can get compared to what we did last year get smaller and smaller, just given the nature of the business and what's left there to try to go after. When we reduced $100 million last year, it'd be very difficult to replicate that again this year or into the future at that level. So that's where we need the regional support to sort of work towards a 3% cap. The next slide shows that, in effect, that if we are able to keep the 3% growth cap versus if we don't and we continue growing at the rate we've been doing, what that means in large totals. And the next slide breaks that down by jurisdictions. In effect, the orange being what would be required from the local governments to maintain the operating growth rates that we historically been in under versus what's shown in the blue if we are able to keep to the 3%. The next slide is this. I just want to make sure we're clear on what we're proposing. The 3% cap that we are proposing is only for existing service. It does not include any new service. So for anything that comes along the line, obviously we know the Silver Line's coming. We know Potomac Yards is coming. But if we want any new or expanded routes or more frequent service, all that's got to be above and beyond that 3%. Clearly, Metro Access, as we continue to try to keep those costs manageable, as you know, is roughly subsidized at $50 per ride. As we've tried these other things to drive that down, but if those numbers go up as the community changes, that's not in those numbers. And clearly, the legacy bargaining numbers and then what may happen in current contracts are not in those numbers because we don't want to predict what those are, but they would have to be dealt with as well going forward. So to stay within the 3%, again, I think it's going to take a lot from management and I think from the region as a whole. We want to focus on increasing non-fare revenues, obviously advertising and concessions, and that brings a lot of things that we have to wrestle with, everything from naming stations and things like that that we may or may not go to, but those are the types of things that we're looking at, different public-private partnerships that we want to do as well. Increasing fare revenues, we want to get, as we increase ridership, we will get more revenue, so we want to focus on that by providing reliable service. We want to enforce the fare policies we have in place. As we came to you in the summer, we want to try some things on the parking side. Again, joint development is all avenues that we can get additional revenues to soften the impact of the operating growth. We also want to leverage the capital investments we have made, particularly things like signal prioritization and bus lanes and things like that, where we have the capital investment there, but we're spending more and more tying up on the operating side because there's stopping traffic in effect. We can get much more productivity out of our capital investment with some of those things that we could do. We will continue to work on just controlling our costs internally with absentees and workers' comps and overtime and things of that sort. And I think we continually, you know, going into the future, always have to look at what's the right mix of bus service and rail service that we provide, given what's happening in our community, whether it's drop in ridership, movement of people, however, you know, whatever plays out. But I don't think we should just assume that the current system goes on for the next 10 years. We should constantly be reviewing that. And then finally, the rainy day fund, it's fairly self-explanatory as things come up. To give, in effect, the jurisdictions more certainty of what their exposure is if we have the rainy day fund, we can do that. Otherwise, when things come up, we have to go back to local jurisdictions and come up with those dollars to support that. So that's the thinking there. We want to build it over the 10-year period to support that. So with that, I'd be glad to take any questions or comments you may have, but I just thought, since we haven't met in a few months, and there's been some changes out there. I just thought it'd be good for us before we get into the details of the budget for 19 that we understand sort of the larger framework.
No, I appreciate your report and the update. I think it's very valuable for the Finance Committee to get that background, especially in light of the developments over the summer and most recently with the summit and the Governor Hogan's proposal. Let me ask you two questions and then we'll open it up to others. With regard to Governor Hogan's proposal, and just so we can get that slide back up there, I want to make sure I understand how the governor's proposal is reflected in this slide. Am I correct that on the left hand from FY18 for the jurisdictional contribution, the $355 million, what you've done is that you've grossed that up for FY19 by his proposal that each of the three compact jurisdictions would contribute an additional $125 million.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
So it's basically the sum of the $359 plus the $375, the $125 times three.
Exactly.
Okay. And then on the federal government, you've then increased that as well by adding $125 million to the historic amount of $461 million anticipated in this fiscal year. Is that correct?
Yes, it's the formula and it's the PREA funding.
Okay, so the composition of that for the federal government are formula money, the PREA money, the $150 million, plus the $125 million proposed by the governor.
Exactly.
And as I read the chart, the result of that is that it provides a solution, a full funding of the capital budget for the next three fiscal years, 19, 20, and 21.
Just under in 21, but yes, it does.
Okay.
Basically.
And at that same period, the capital budget is being ramped up from 1.228 to 1.5 billion in FY22. And the reason that there's a gap in FY22 is because of that ramp up. That's essentially the combination of the 500 million from the jurisdictions and the traditional funding sources doesn't get you to that ramp up for FY22 and as well as for the following years. And I think my math is that the difference is about $188 million. I just wanted to make sure that's about right in terms
of
income. Okay.
Again, but remember, this is not a budget. You know, this is a high-level programming exercise here, so let's not get to
it. It may end up in the budget, but for today's purposes, it's high-level programming. And I just wanted to ask you a question on, let's see, I guess it's the next one. It's the one that's entitled Investing $1.5 billion over the next 10 years. Yeah. Doing the math on this, I took the numbers, and the range seems to be between $11 billion and $21 billion for the 10-year period. So I guess that's what got you to the sweet spot of $15.5 billion for the 10 years. Is that correct?
Yes. We're looking at 10 years. We're assuming, you know, we have to make lots of assumptions when projects come on, what we know about them. But, you know, it gives you a sense of the scale. So the example I keep giving is Northern Bus Garage. We have a 110-year-old bus garage. It literally is, we have, you know, major operation and literally the physical plant is collapsing around us. So we know that. It's got to be replaced. But we've got to go through, you know, all types of issues to find out what does that look like to replace. So that's why, but we know it's coming. We know it's in this ballpark range of dollars, but we don't have a project there yet. And that's why you got to ramp this up a little bit and create those projects, particularly for those large capital investments like that. Power and rail and things like that, that's a little bit easier because you can do, you know, it's more math, straightforward math. But for larger projects, it's a little lumpier.
I guess the question I wanted to ask you was a tougher one. Mm-hmm. And really that is, if Metro is unsuccessful getting the dedicated funding passed by the legislatures or the jurisdictions and the federal government failing to reach agreement on Governor Hogan's transitional proposal, which of these projects would be placed in jeopardy if the 10-year proposed budget of $15.5 billion could not be fully funded?
I think this would be a little different than the approach management has taken in the past, which is these projects cannot be in jeopardy. Because in my estimation, these projects are the projects that are keeping the system safe and reliable. So if we don't do these projects, we're putting the system at safety risk. That's what SafeTrack started as, in effect, a maintenance reliability issue, but it grew to a major safety issue. So I don't think we should repeat that mistake, particularly now that we're 40 years old. And we don't want to undermine the revenue side of it. Because if we don't do these things, we're not reliable, and we're chasing customers away. So to me, the issue is this has to pretty much go forward unless we're going to back away from safety and reliability, which I don't think as a management team, we would not recommend that, and I'm hoping the board would agree with that.
Now, basically what you're saying is we can't afford not to do these $15.5 billion of projects over the next 10 years.
Exactly.
Okay. Other questions? We'll just go around the room. Mr. Horner. Charlie, Slobby,
just a comment. I just really appreciate the fact that we've got this now. I think this really does help us to set the conversation earlier about next year as well, which, of course, we're going to soon face. One question I did have is you showed debt in the current year, but you did not show that in the out years. Can you help to explain that for me?
Sure. Dennis can jump in as well. But generally, since we do a year-to-year budgeting process versus a longer one, the local governments have decided to sell debt. But going into the future, in effect, that debt is competing against other things they're doing at the local level. And what we've heard from, in some cases, they literally maybe are capped at what they can sell in debt. Basis competing against other things they've got to do. So that's why they're saying, look, we can't keep growing at this rate. You've got to come to us with some other plan.
Yeah, absolutely. In addition, general manager's plan actually contemplates the use of those dedicated revenue sources to actually provide debt on behalf of the region without having the region be responsible for those payments.
So just again, just for kind of like another clarification, that debt that you're showing there is jurisdictional debt and not WMATA debt, or is it? No, I know. So I'm just trying to understand versus the dedicated revenue source where you feel like you'll have an extend your ability to raise debt in that way, correct? That's what.
Correct.
That's how it looks different.
That's
between those two? Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Bolger.
On the rainy day fund, Paul, if you don't have an ironclad policy on that, I don't think it's going to be a non-starter. I mean, you know, be, people are just going to rip it off, you know, like collective bargaining, you know, it'll go over there or go over there. I think that's a great idea to have a rainy day fund. I just wish that we could, you know, firewall it. That would be my recommendation, that, you know, impenetrable, unless, you know, for emergencies. You know. So thanks for doing this high-level stuff. I understand, Michael, these are not project-related. They're not down to the detail, but they're in the 30,000 feet level for our purposes. Thanks.
Mr. Thayer.
Thank you, Mr. Goldman. So, Mr. Riedefeld, thank you for your last response before Mr. Augustine's question, where you talked really about this not being a project wish list, but really the baseline for delivering the kind of system and not devaluing the asset. I don't think you can be loud or as blunt. I don't think you can be too loud or too blunt about those issues. I think there's a general misconception that, you know, state of good repair provides optional things that you could pick and choose. But really, this is about a fundamental return to a baseline level of safety and reliability that's essential if this is going to be an asset that's going to be performing for the region. So I would just encourage you to continue to say that message as sharply as you did just a few minutes ago. Question on slide 17 of the presentation, and looking at how we're looking at the operating subsidy cap containments. And I want to just have you delve a little bit more deeply into the things that you consider not a part of your commitment to the 3% growth. Obviously, phase two of the Silver Line, new stations should not be there, but I'd like for you to speak a little bit more about, you know, the bus routes, metro access, and why you are holding them separately. Is not a part of your commitment to managing and containing cost growth. It would seem to me that, you know, metro access is a core function, one that we can project future growth. There ought to be some discipline in there in terms of controlling costs. And, you know, bus routes, it's not just about sort of new service that's a burden to the agency. I know at least a lot of the jurisdictions think about how do we make bus service more efficient. How do we deliver more people into the core of the system who are then going to be transit users overall, who are currently not a part of the system at all? So why are we thinking about new bus routes as something that's an add-on and not really a part of a core business strategy for maintaining an efficient system?
Sure. No, I agree. I mean, we're in the business of providing transit service. We want to do more of it. But my concern is that maybe we've done that in the past where we've added service without recognizing that now we've committed for years to come at this level. And I just want to make sure as a region, when we do that, it's clear that that's not part of the existing system. It actually has a cost, and that cost go on into the future. So that's really more what I was getting at. And like, for instance, on the metro access, so if we move towards a 24-hour system, and we're going to be providing a lot more at metro access, for instance. So not only so when we make that decision that we want to go back in hours, maybe in 2 years, whatever we want to do, there's other costs that come with that. And we can't constrain the budget if we're adding things. I mean, it's fine to grow the budget. That's fine. But what we're going to be managing to is the 3%. But as we collectively want more service, we add it, and we add more money to it. And it's not assumed that somehow it's taken care of in the existing budget. That's what I was trying to get to with this.
I just think this is probably going to be an area where it'll be constant push and pull with, you know, management, finance committee, and the board on what exactly constitutes new and additional that's not a part of what we're viewing as a core business function. This is not I'm not raising a red flag, but it's just something that I don't think can neatly be encapsulated by new or not or current services or not, because I would hope that we're going to be in the business of always looking at inefficiencies in the bus and the rail and trying to replace them with things that may be considered new, but that are, you know, part of a good business practice. So
I understand your point. Yeah, it's a good point.
More?
There's always more, but not.
Ms. Porter.
I just wanted to thank you for the additional detail. I think this will be very helpful in terms of explaining and discussing this proposal with people. So thank you very much.
Mr. Costa.
Thank you and good morning. This is really helpful. sets us up for good discussions the next few months. I understand where we are in the refinement of the needs inventory. I have a couple questions about capital investment levels. And I understand these aren't projects. I just want to make sure I understand, and it could be just the words we're using on the slide. Going to slide four, there's about $9.5 million that's labeled as needs not yet prioritized for funding in the next 10 years. And then I look at the appendix, and there's a discussion of potential needs above the $15.5 billion. I'm just trying to understand whether that $10 billion represents stuff we don't really know about yet, or we haven't refined, or are they truly not priorities?
They're things that, a little bit of all the above, okay? So an example would be the Roslyn Tunnel. So, you know, is it something that we would want to look at? Yes. Is it a definitive need? Let's look at it first. What would that look like? What would that cost be to that? How would we address that? So it's, for instance, that's one that would be in there. We don't have a hard number by any means of what that would be. And, you know, what's the pluses and minuses of doing something there? That's what it's trying to capture, some of those types of projects.
Okay, I think for me, I struggle a little bit because there's a difference between we don't have a refined number, that doesn't mean it's not going to be a priority in 2 years, versus you were saying it's a need, we just don't think it's a priority. Those are two really different paths to go down. I make sure I understand what that 9.5 to 10 billion.
Yeah, I guess where we came down is we put, the first bucket is what we know we need to keep the existing system safe and reliable, and other things fall into the other bucket. That's maybe not as defined as it could be.
Okay, so but it sounds like more of not a priority rather than just we need to refine the numbers, and then we'll add them to that list.
Probably.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Smedberg?
Thank you. Mr. Wiedefeld, I had just a quick question about you mentioned the review of assets. How wide a review is that? Is it a certain segment of the assets that you're planning for? And how, you know, detailed?
Last I saw it was 80,000 some quote assets.
Yeah.
So it is a extensive review. And again, it's driven by the federal process, which is the philosophy is, you know, it's a national policy that basically says we don't want to keep investing in new things if you're not taking care of the old stuff. So that's what's behind it. So they're requiring every trans agency in the country to do this. So we started it again last year, and we've identified, literally, you know, inventoried that, and then we did some math upon that. Some we know more about, some we don't. Then we have obviously professional judgment. We've done asset inventories before, but it's been done more, a little bit more professional judgment. You know, we ask the people, what are your needs? This is much more detailed. Now we're doing the actual, what's the physical condition? What is its true life cycle? Or what is its need? Because, you know, different things of the system may need to be placed much quicker, even though they may not age out for longer term.
And two other quick comments. I really like the idea of, you know, giving some sort of reliability or predictability to the jurisdictions, particularly, you know, on the Virginia side where the localities are stroking the checks. That would be, you know, is a really helpful, I think, practice. And then the rainy day fund, I think, obviously, a good idea, but capping it or restricting it to the capital projects is right on in my project, in my view.
Mr. McMillan?
Thank you. First of all, just echoing the comments of some of the others here, that the clarity on, especially when it comes to the capital side investments that need to be made, that you get the system you pay for, and putting off those kinds of things means you're going to get the kind of system you didn't pay for. And it's important that all the stakeholders understand those trade-offs. Again, just to comment, the assets inventory you talked about, as we are justifying our the investments, our 100% operating explanation.
Same slide that Mr. Dorsey was asking about?
Yes.
Yeah, it's one entitled Operating Subsidy Cap Commitment.
There. Legacy collective bargaining agreements. Everything on that checklist seems to be things we haven't incurred yet, but the word legacy implies somebody's already accrued a benefit and we need to go back and look at a benefit already accrued. Is that an accurate way to interpret the word legacy in that case?
It is. So the collective bargaining agreement with Metro employees expired in FY16. Mm-hmm. So since then, we've been engaged in negotiations with the union. And to the extent, and the budget, which we've been explicit with this board, is that, you know, the FY17 and FY18 budgets do not contain any reserves should management's position, you know, not prevail. So what we're trying to make clear here is that, you know, to the extent that we get a result that's inconsistent with our expectations, that those costs will have to be discussed and are not part of the 3%.
Okay.
So just along those lines, I'm sorry.
Okay, so to the extent management's position does not prevail and some legacy policies continue going forward, that's not contemplated in 3%. Is that what I heard you say?
That's right.
Okay, thank you.
I was just going to suggest maybe just for housekeeping purposes, it might be good to explain that a little bit more, because it's not necessarily the legacy agreements. It's bargaining awards above and beyond management's practice that's the issue. That's a very good point that our board member raised.
Let me just stick with this chart for a minute and ask a follow-up question. I think for the funding jurisdictions, the 3% cap on the operating growth, you know, whether that's ephemeral or a real line will depend on what are these carve-outs and how big they are and when they will hit. To use a transportation metaphor, you know, is this big enough to drive a truck through, or is this a real target that the jurisdictions that have to fund WMATA in future years can count on? So I guess the follow-up question would be, can you give us some greater granular sense of how much is involved in Silverline Phase 2, for example, that's not covered, or a Potomac station, yard station, and when these might hit? Are these things likely to hit in FY19, or are they further out?
As we create the 19 budget, then that's when those, you know, we'll see where the project is, and if the project requires us to start to ramp up in 19, we will come forward with dollars there. We're just not there yet. Again, this isn't the budget discussion yet, but this was just trying to frame out that as these new things come on, they're going to have to get covered somewhere. And to think that we can keep squeezing the operating budget to take on new initiatives, I understand Mr. Dorsey's point, that it doesn't mean that we don't do new initiatives to be more efficient and try to save things that way. I get it. But it does not include that yet. And so we just want to raise the flag that so people don't think, okay, well, the Silver Line's coming, that's in the 3%, for instance. We know it's coming, whether it's 19, whether it flips into 20, it's irrelevant for this discussion. It's just that it will be a new cost that can't be absorbed in the 3% cap. Yeah. And remember, the 3% cap on operating, I mean, there's a number of things there that help support that, you know, of the plan that we put out. So, you know, if those things don't come to fruition, then it's going to be that much harder to keep to that.
So I think what you're saying is the flag may wave in FY19, but we won't know until you've actually done the work and decided whether some of these things are going to hit in FY19.
That's right. But as a management approach, we're going to try to work to that 3% in 19.
Okay. Just one more question on the operating side for a second round. The prior slide, I think, we can just hit that. On the revenue side, you're showing here that the forecast of the approved budget of FY18 of $845 million, but then you're showing a revenue decline for the following 3 years. And I guess I'm now that SafeTrax is done, I guess I'm trying to get a better sense of why you're, even in this big 30,000 foot projection, why you're forecasting a decline in revenue for the next 3 years.
When you look at 19 specifically, a couple of things are going anticipated. The first one being the assumption of the services for the circulator by the district instead of Metro.
I'm sorry, say again?
The circulator moving to the district.
Moving back to the district. So that reflects the reduction of the revenue base. And I mentioned earlier that we're seeing some rebound in ridership, but it's still relatively weak. And so what we're looking for FY19 is to recalibrate in terms of where we expect revenue will be, and then you'll see the growth from there.
Okay. That's the first good news I've heard about it, reduction in revenue in a long time. Any other questions? Mr. Bolger, you get a second round since... No, because your colleagues aren't with you today.
We received, the market responded quite favorably to the bond sale, which resulted in additional premiums as a result of that issuance. And those premiums, as we communicated with the board, belongs to the jurisdictions that participated in the sale.
What? I couldn't hear.
The premiums that were received as a result of that issuance belongs to the jurisdictions that participated in the bond sale.
I know that. But we went over what we I thought we anticipated at the end of the market by a considerable amount.
We did not sell. I mean, the market offered you premiums because of the high interest in the bonds.
Yeah.
So we ended up receiving more money than the power amount that was approved by the board. Correct.
How much more did we
sell in
debt?
We sold. The board approved about 585
something
in that range, but we ended up getting a lot more than that.
How much more?
We ended up getting, I think, $90 million.
That's great.
Most of about $25 million of which was actually used to capitalize interest for the first year, because the jurisdictions did not want to pay interest in first year. The rest of it, we've communicated with the jurisdictions that you know they've got this more amount here that which they will use to reduce their capital contributions to Metro over the next year or so, as they choose to do so.
But that's the jurisdictions that
correct
did that versus the jurisdictions that didn't do, like Arlington didn't.
Which
I remember we talked about this.
That's correct.
Okay, I just have one more final question. It has nothing to do with it has more about the 30,000 feet, Paul, and Dennis. What's the temperature for the jurisdictions to float debt collectively using their bond rating for us? Because our bond rating is not as good as Fairfax or Arlington. And they do this in Boston. And there's a term, the guarantee or something, that is floated by the jurisdictions and it's dedicated to MBTA. Is there any possibility that could be discussed?
There are several options being discussed at the regional level, but none of those options entail the structure that you just described.
Okay.
As the GM pointed out a little bit earlier, each jurisdiction have the right to obviously issue debt on their behalf and to provide those funds to Metro, and always have the right to opt out of any issuance by Metro. But at this point, the construct that you're describing is not being discussed within the region.
It's too sophisticated for the national metropolitan nation's capital.
Are you offering the district's borrowing power?
I'd be willing to discuss it with our CFO. Using the Boston model, Kathy, as a starting point. I'm not
right.
If we were to move to a dedicated source to the agency, in effect, you would get to the same place because you'd have a dedicated source, which we could sell with a much higher rate.
Thank you. Any other questions before we? Mr. Horner.
question but to recommend to management that it follow the work of Transport for London, the agency responsible for the London Underground and bus network serving the greater London area, because it's an organization regarded globally as a thought leader in provision of transit service and is embarking on an aggressive capital plan to deliver new capacity as well as to trim organizational cost. I also understand that Transport for London has offered to the world to second some of its experts through a newly established affiliated consultancy, and I'd just be delighted if you considered conferring with them.
Okay. We actually use them today.
Well done.
Ms. Hutchins?
Yes, we had a question here regarding the 3% that's capped for the budget and whether it reflects the, a different percentage of 3% on the subsidy as it comes in. And that would be different in terms of how we look at the subsidy and as a contribution. So you're looking, we're keeping the budget at 3%. That's the expectation? Capped, yes. Yeah.
The proposal that we put forward called for a number of things to occur to support that 3% cap. Mm-hmm. So we will try to work within what we can do without some of those things potentially being in place. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Right.
Because we just can't,
right.
You know, there's some things in there that would help drive that 3% cap. And if they don't occur, it makes it much more difficult to hold to that. Mm-hmm.
And that could affect the contributions as they come in, and it will or will not be the 3%. It could be a different percentage.
Yes, I mean it's built on that.
Yeah, that's.
Thank you, gentlemen, Mr. Wiedefeld, Mr. Anasecki, Mr. Webster. That completes our business today. Next month, the Finance Committee will continue this preparatory work to the presentation of the FY19 budget, in that we will have a report on the first quarter results of the current fiscal year, so we'll get some sense of ridership and in the post-Safe Tracks era, which will be helpful to us as we get to the F19 budget. And we will have a nationally recognized consultant give us a presentation on ridership trends nationally in other systems.
What's the name of the consultant?
Look forward to this site for more good work next month.
What is the name of the consultant?
I'm sorry?
I didn't hear the name of the consultant.
I didn't give a name of the consultant.
What is the name of the consultant?
Could we have the room quiet down for just a quick moment, please?
It's Mr. Davey, Rick Davey from Boston Consulting Group.
Oh, right.
And I now will turn the floor over to the first vice chair, Ms. Harley, who has a motion.
In accordance with the bylaws, Icatur Harley requests that the Board of Directors convene an executive session to discuss the following matters pursuant to Article 2, Paragraph 9, Subsections B, litigation, investigations, and other legal matters requiring the provision of legal advice or consultation with counsel and staff members, and C, personnel or labor issues, including discussion of labor contracts and labor negotiations, considerations or interviews of candidates for employment, and the assignment, appointment, promotion, performance, demotion, or resignation of individuals, and contractual or other matters involving confidential proprietary concerns or the investment of public funds where discussion in public would adversely affect the financial interests of WMATA. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. Thank you.
Thank you.